Just a word about the character on the front of your order of service. This ungainly, pigeon-like bird lived on Mauritius a long time, probably thousands of years. It was an evolutionary success. It lived nowhere else. Most likely it ate fallen fruit, seeds, and bulbs. It grew big and husky, storing fat to a degree that true pigeons could not. It ran through the forest on stout legs. As its body evolved toward greater size, its wings did not. At some point, it dispensed with flying. This compromise yielded more advantage than disadvantage. A bird so hefty, with a big head and a wide gape, could swallow sizable fruits whole, pounding down big meals and stockpiling nutrients efficiently during the seasons of bounty. On the negative side, flightlessness meant no escape from enemies. But that was an easy sacrifice. Since Mauritius contained no terrestrial predators, no rodents, no humans, the last credible eyewitness account of living dodos dates from 1662. A Dutchman named Volkart Iversen and his shipmates were marooned on Mauritius after their ship was wrecked. Hungry and desperate, they scoured for food. Iversen evidently found no dodos at all on the Mauritius mainland, but he did see some dodos on a small islet just off the coast, near enough that he and the others could walk to it at low tide. Amongst other birds, said Iversen, there were some larger than geese but not able to fly. Instead of wings, they had small flaps, but they could run very fast. Iversen's account makes good ecological sense. The small water gap must have been just enough to protect the little islet from the pigs and monkeys on the Mauritius mainland. His testimony reads, when we held one by the leg, he let out a cry. Others came running forward to help the prisoner, and they were themselves caught. Of course, the Dutchmen weren't wrestling with the birds for entertainment. Without doubt, Iversen helped to kill and eat a few dodos, which may have been the last of the species. Iversen and his mates were lucky. After just 5 days, they were rescued by a passing ship. No living dodo has been seen since. The song of the dodo. The cry of a lumbering bird driven to extinction 350 years ago on a remote island in the southern Indian Ocean. So what does this flightless bird have to do with us here on Ironbound Road? What does natural history teach us about ecological harmony amidst climatic, tectonic, and human-generated events that can become tipping points of change and often extinction? And how might this congregation foster healthy, ecologically sound ways of honoring diversity as we make our values real? As you anticipate calling your next settled minister, how might this congregation continue to foster agility, resilience, and adaptive capacities so as to be a learning organization? Let's consider the natural world. What does natural history teach us about togetherness and harmony? Is togetherness ever a recipe for disaster? The greatest mass extinction in Earth history happened at the end of the Permian, 230 million years ago. 95% of all species gone. For a relatively brief time, all of the Earth's land masses were connected in a huge supercontinent, which geologists named Pangaea. And when Pangaea became the only place to go, with no natural boundaries, no constraints on opportunistic, invasive, predatory behavior, it spelled ecological disaster. There were no boundaries. Wait, it's not so simple. If too much closeness can be disastrous, too much isolation may also spell disaster. Let's look at birds. In the last 500 years or so, 171 bird species are known to have gone extinct. And 90% of these extinct birds lived on islands. Moreover, only one-fifth of all bird species live on islands. So what this means is that island-dwelling birds have been 50 times more likely to go extinct. So too much isolation can also spell disaster. Amidst natural catastrophes and extinctions, long ago or close to home, even in this moment, animals such as the Yangtze River dolphin, the Pyrenean ibex, the Javan tiger. One can ask, if a species goes extinct, extinction is a natural process. It's the drumbeat of evolution in a way. There have always been extinctions. Why worry about those caused by human activity? After all, human activity is one component of thriving and surviving. So toughen up, get in the game. Is survival the only game in town? Here we are, friends, in a Milky Way of 100 billion stars on the third planet of a small sun, enclosed in an envelope of mixed gases, hovering within a very narrow temperature range that allows life to flourish. We're dependent on the rhythms of ice and warmth, the drifting seas, the fresh rains. We are recent arrivals on the evolutionary scene. Bipeds in sneakers, mammals with large thumbs, Serbs, Palestinians, Sioux, Quakers, Pentecostals, Maoris. We are so improbable in the first place. Why can't we be more worthy companions to one another? I want to return to Alfred Lord Tennyson, the poet laureate of England. Tennyson was born in the same year as Darwin, 1809. The Tennyson household, with a dozen siblings, came to know very well the family of the famous historian Henry Hallam. Their two families were an extended family. In fact, Tennyson and Arthur Hallam, Henry's son, were undergrads at Trinity College, Cambridge, at the same time, and became strong friends. Each was a brilliant writer. And as the families grew closer, Arthur Hallam was engaged to be married to Tennyson's sister, Emily. But then, tragedy. September 1833, Arthur Hallam, at age 22, died suddenly in Vienna of a brain aneurysm while touring Europe with his father. The loss was devastating to Tennyson. Its impact upon him endured a long time. What happened? Tennyson's first response to Arthur Hallam's tragic death was to write a short poem entitled Ulysses, a poem that many of us know. It's a tribute to human endurance and steadfastness amidst tragic loss. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Tennyson wrote Ulysses just a month after Arthur Hallam's tragic death. Ulysses was Tennyson's immediate way of saying, yes, I have been deeply wounded, and yet 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. My purpose is to keep on striving, to sail beyond the sunset, beyond this particular tragedy. Though much has been taken away, much remains nevertheless. Tennyson was fortifying his broken heart amidst a deeply painful loss so that he could live forward with his head held high. And then comes the interesting part. Over the next 17 years, Tennyson wrote a much longer poem entitled In Memoriam, A.H.H. A.H.H., of course, was his friend Arthur Hallam. This poem was Tennyson's quest for peace and renewed faith amidst a devastating loss. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert especially liked this poem. It's some 500 stanzas in length. And after Prince Albert's death in 1861, Queen Victoria declared that In Memoriam to her was her most important source of hope and renewal. Why would I mention In Memoriam? It engages the relationship which has been, in a way, the pulse, the synapse of my ongoing life and ministry. That intersection between science and human values, or between stuff that's true and stuff that matters. Tennyson was both a scientist and a poet, sensitive to the hungers and anguishes of humanity. He presents several descriptions of nature in this lengthy poem. Red in tooth and claw, a domain of death for all species, a realm of steady progress through history. All of those myths he rejects. Because, not because they're not true, but because they are not quite sufficient to explain and resolve his emotional and ethical quest. Science cannot, he says, provide answers for moral questions about life's meaning. Nature is not meant to be a source of moral instruction. He writes, "We do not get our faith from nature or the world. If we look at nature alone, with its perfections and imperfections, she may suggest that God is disease or murder. We must reshape faithful responses from within ourselves." Does that sound like UUism? We must shape faithful responses from within ourselves, from what is highest within us. And then these words from In Memoriam. "Our little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they." What then shall we make of Tennyson's wrestling with his personal tragedy? Note that his struggle involved both responses. He first needed the Ulyssesian response. Within just a few days of Arthur's funeral, he could write in Ulysses, "Death closes all, but some work of noble note may yet be done. So come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world." He was saying to himself, "Chin up, Buster. It's not over. The world awaits you. So let's get with it." And then comes Tennyson's In Memoriam, a response that took him 17 years to give shape to. In Memoriam is not a proud, strident, triumphant declaration. It is a humble struggle to come to terms with our mortality and with the limits of data and arguments in giving meaning and value to our lives. When Tennyson died in October 1892, he was buried alongside of England's greatest in Westminster Abbey. At the time, Britain's leading scientist was Thomas Henry Huxley, who was also the most eloquent defender of Charles Darwin. Huxley was invited, he was chosen, to eulogize Tennyson in Westminster Abbey at the funeral. And Huxley offered these words: "And lay him gently down among the men of state, the men of song, the thought-worn chieftains of the mind, head servants of the humankind." In Huxley's eulogy, he named Tennyson as the only poet since the time of Lucretius who has taken the trouble to understand the work of scientists. Tennyson had sought to harmonize the ways of nature, red in tooth and claw, perhaps, with the moral imperative that we love each other. And what might Tennyson's 17-year journey with In Memoriam represent? I believe it has to do with an old-fashioned word that we don't hear so much anymore. That word is abide, A-B-I-D-E. Many of us remember, "Abide with me," a hymn that we occasionally hear again. Abiding is staying with it, persevering. Perhaps that word is becoming rare because the experience of abiding is rare, and yet its absence is diminishing us. Lacking the capacity to abide, friendships dissolve. So do treaties between nations. Business contracts become tissue thin. Even marriage covenants can become recyclable. Perhaps for some folks, as we move into the world of social media, perhaps this will foster the quality of abiding. Let's pay a close attention and see. A capacity to say, "I will stay with you no matter the 10,000 miles between us. I will stay with you, and I will not unfriend you or click you away when you seem to be no longer useful." Perhaps the power of an abiding presence, whether virtual or face-to-face, can transform the brokenness in this world and can feed the deeper hungers of humanity. We began with a bird, the dodo. I want to conclude with a bird still with us. The poet E.E. Cummings pays tribute to a living bird, a purple finch, a bird not yet on the endangered species list. Cummings writes, "A purple finch, oh purple finch, please tell me why this summer world and you who love to live must die." And then the bird responds, "If I should tell you anything," that eagerly sweet caroling self answers me, "I could not sing." Let's paraphrase that. "Oh, purple finch, please tell me why this summer world must die, and tell me why you and I, who love so much to live, must also one day die." And then the little finch, that eager, sweet, caroling finch, answers in reply, "If I should tell you anything, if I could give you correct answers to that question of yours, if I really had a convincing and persuasive answer, verified by corroborating testimony and agreed to by those in a position to know, if I could resolve for you the wonder and the mystery of this life, I could not sing." And the poem ends there. The poem might have continued, I suppose. I mean, if this particular finch really did have an arsenal of rational explanations for why we live and die as we do, then this sophisticated finch might have continued the poem and said, "So what will it be, Buster? Do you want a rational answer to the meaning of life, or would you like me to sing for you?" Perhaps if Tennyson were here today, And if he could speak to that little purple finch, his words would give honor to both knowledge and to reverence, to both. And with these words of Tennyson from In Memoriam, we shall close. Let knowledge grow from more to more, but may more of reverence in us dwell, that mind and soul, according well, may make one music as before.